Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Sedaris, whose latest book is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, a collection of essays and some stories. Also the author of Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk, which we'll talk about. When You Were Engulfed in Flames, Me Talk Pretty One Day. This is the eighth book, I believe.
It's number eight. I don't know how that happened. I have no idea how that happened.
And somewhere along the line, there's also several, I guess, CDs of your work as well. NPR, still doing material for NPR that people are laughing at. And you're doing a lot of work in front of audiences. And I want to start there. What's it like? Is it like being a stand-up comedian when you're getting up in front of, like, an audience of 500 people?
I started this tour on April 2nd. And so I started it with a bunch of new stories, and so I'd read out loud and go back to the room and rewrite it and read and rewrite. And then I think, like, there was one story in particular that worked out well. And then after I'd rewritten it 18 times, and then I'd just send it to The New Yorker. And then, so now I'm rewriting it again, you know, making some changes for The New Yorker, and we are actually closing it today. Like, I'll be in the backseat of a car saying, I guess it's okay to move that comma. But, you know, I mean, it started a couple months ago, but I consider myself fortunate to be able to edit in front of an audience.
So basically what you're doing is you're testing your material in front of an audience, seeing the reaction, sort of like previews of a theater piece.
Yeah, yeah. And just because something works out loud doesn't mean it's going to work on the page, right? I mean, you can cheat when you're reading out loud. You can do things with your voice. You can, sometimes your biggest laugh is from looking up. And you can't imitate that on a page. And you don't want to because it just looks gimmicky. You know, like to put like three double spaces between paragraphs and then just one single word. It just looks cheap on the page. But it's a huge part of it for me. If I couldn't read out loud, I don't know what I'd do. When I'm sitting in alone in a room, I really look forward to being on stage and reading something out loud.
Well, when you started out, you weren't doing that. You were actually having to write and read it into a microphone. Yeah.
Right. And doing it to a microphone to the radio isn't the same thing because you don't know when to pause and you don't know, you know, like right now we're doing this in front of a microphone, but I can't picture the people who are listening. I don't know where they are. I don't know what they look like. And now when I get to the theater, I like for it to be dark. I don't want to look people in the eye, but, you know, lights come up during question and answer, and I think, oh, that's what you look like.
Well, also, you know, you can hear them at all times as
right.
well. When you went on this tour, did you start with, like, 10 or 15 unfinished essays?
No, I started because I turned the book in January, and then in the middle of January. I'm sorry, middle of February.
This book?
Yeah. And I started the tour in April, so I didn't have that much time to write new things. So I wrote three new things, and one of them just didn't work. Just didn't work. I thought everyone could relate to it, and I was wrong. And another one, I didn't really have an ending to it. And I'm not going to read something that doesn't have an ending. And I thought, well, I'll write the ending. But then, you know, once you get on tour, you've got so much work to do and different city every day, and it just... But I learned things that I can reapply to the story. It was an essay, really, about guns. Because I live in England, and so, you know, that's what everyone there says. What is up with you people and your goddamn guns, you know? And I never knew what to tell them. I didn't come from a gun family. And I didn't think anyone in my audience would have a gun, but I was so wrong. So I've talked to a lot of people who have guns, and it's just been really interesting to me.
Well, when you say you talk to them, you mean the bookstores or signings?
Yeah, I sign books. And, like, I developed a theory on this tour. At the beginning, my theory was guys with beards have guns. And then I realized guys with beards have fathers who have guns. Right? 90% right on that. Meet a guy with a beard and say, does your father have a gun? I find. Now, of course, it depends on where you are. In Arizona, you're going to be 100% right. Because everyone
right,
in Arizona has a gun. But with women, a lot of women, you know, their fathers have guns, but I don't see the common denominator in the women. Whereas with guys, it's having a beard.
So you were able to actually have somebody come up to you with a beard and you'd say, does your father own a gun?
Yep. Yeah, I'm sitting at a table, signing books, you know, for 8 hours, and guys with beards come up, and that's my question to a guy with a beard.
Is that your only question?
No. You know, my other question is, I like to eat dinner while I sign books.
Okay.
Because otherwise, you're getting back to the room at 2 o'clock in the morning, and by the time room service comes, it's going to be 3. So I like to eat while I'm signing books. But if I have a steak or like a piece of chicken or something, if a guy comes up and he's a straight guy, I say, will you cut a piece of that meat for me while I sign your book? And then he'll do it, and then I'll say, now I need you to fork it into my mouth. And they do it, you know, and I think, how do I feel about this? Like, how bad should I feel about this? And I don't know, I don't feel so bad about it. And I realize it's my 20-year-old self's definition of success, is to have straight men cut his meat and fork it into his mouth. I couldn't do it in normal life. Like,
right.
I couldn't go through a restaurant and tap someone on the shoulder and say, oh, will you come over to my table and cut me a piece of meat and fork it in my mouth? And they'd say, no, I'm not going to do that.
They always do it.
Yeah, they always do it. It's not a cheap thing. It's not like saying, oh, bend over. You know, it's not like that. It's just, I mean, I think if I were them, I wouldn't mind doing it because, you know, it can be awkward. You're getting a book signed. And you don't really know what to say and all that stuff. So if the author gives you a little task, you know, it's not hard to cut a piece of meat. You know, I'm not asking to do anything that difficult. And I'm not asking to put it in my mouth with their fingers. You know, just with the fork, just to raise a fork to my mouth. I love signing books. You know, I love doing it. And really, it's a lot of fun to me. But in New York, like last week, I said to somebody, I signed their book, and I said, now I need for you to kiss my hand. And I started off with a woman, and she said, I'm not going to do that. She said, I'm not going to kiss your hand. She said, I'm sorry, I like your book, but I'm not going to kiss your hand. And nobody would kiss my hand. And then my publicist said, that's just going too far. And I said, well, I would kiss their hand. And she said, yeah, but they're not going to ask you. Nobody really wants to. Nobody wants that. But again, it was just like a little experiment, you know, just something I could, I don't know why people will, well, of course, it's a, you know, I mean, I'm there shaking people's hands all day, so asking somebody to kiss the thing that has touched some, you know what I mean? It's like a great way to get sick, I suppose. But it was just something that popped into my head, you know, after like signing books for like 6.5 hours, and then it popped out again.
Well, I mean, it's always fodder for your essays, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't ever know what my theme will be for my tour. I like to have a little theme, but I don't know beforehand what it will be. But you're right, it's really helpful if you're, like, I remember when the last essay collection came out, I polled people. I said, do you think Barack Obama is circumcised or uncircumcised? And I just had them vote on it when they came out to the table. It's not an important question, but it was interesting to see how people thought about it. And men's decisions were, I think, because men are, you know, so often circumcised, their decisions were more fully thought out. You know, they would say, well, okay, Barack Obama is this age, and, you know, almost everyone in the United States who wasn't born in a hospital, who was not born at home, was circumcised then, but he lived in Hawaii. But, you know, they didn't take religious things into consideration. So it was interesting.
It seems as if in Let's Explore Diabetes with Al, you kind of do that about Barack Obama in France, asking people what they thought.
Well, because I was in France during the election, and it was interesting how my neighbors and the people I knew, they were so invested in the election, right? But they all told me that Barack Obama would not be elected because Americans are racist and because Americans would never elect a black president. Now, this was said to me as if France has a long history of black presidents. Like, they love to talk about American racism in France. But if you point out, like, the way that they treat Arabs there, then that's complicated, right? That's not the same thing, you know, according to them. But they love to talk about it in the United States. And so, again, it was like ask an American. Because when you're the foreigner, it's ask the American, you know, people come to me. And it's interesting how, like when people came to me about guns, I didn't know how to answer them. You know, I mean, I had my ideas. I predicted that Barack Obama would win. And when I was right about it, what sort of bothered me in a way was the French reaction was like, how great that you elected the president we thought you should elect. You know, that they had to kind of still have a hand in it some way.
You know, on the other hand, people outside the United States have very specific views about what's happening in the United States. They're going to talk to you. I don't understand how George W. Bush could get enough votes to even win a contested election. So, I mean, if you're asked that question and you're not even living there, I mean, how do you respond to those kinds of things?
Well, because I don't live in the United States, and the only times I'm in the United States are when I'm on tour. Well, like on this tour I'm in right now, I'm going to 60 cities, right? And I went on another tour in the fall, and I went to, like, I don't know, 37, 38 cities. But that said, I'm kind of traveling in a bubble. You know, if I'm in front of an audience, like I was at the Opera House a few weeks ago here, what, 3,200 seats? I don't remember how many seats. It's a pretty big place. But I'll bet you that 99% of the audience voted the way I did. And so I don't write a lot of political things because it just feels like it's just preaching to the converted. You know, I mean, you can get up on stage in a situation like that and you can say Newt Gingrich is an idiot and people will applaud. But you didn't say anything clever. You just said what people wanted to hear in a big gathering. So if I don't have anything clever to say, I just soon not say it. I mean, when I wrote the essay about Barack Obama winning the election, it wasn't about Barack Obama so much as, like, being the go-to American is, to me, what that essay was about.
David Sedaris, in Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, this is the story about your giving a stuffed owl to your partner, Hugh. Is this a true story?
Yeah.
It ends with you taking the stuffed owl to Hugh. What was his reaction?
Oh, he was delighted with it.
Really?
I mean, it was a kind of an extravagant gift for Valentine's Day because it, you know, it cost quite a bit of money. I went to this place in London, and I didn't go there thinking, I'll write a story about buying Hugh an owl for Valentine's Day. But I got to the store, and the taxidermist started showing me things, right? And he had the skeleton of a pygmy. And the British went to the Congo in, like, the 19th century and shot pygmies for sport. So this was the skeleton of one. And then he showed me an arm, a forearm, that his grandfather had mummified. And then he showed me the head of a 14-year-old girl that he had in a plastic grocery bag. And it was just fascinating. And I left, and I wrote a story about it, and the story didn't work. And a couple of years later, I turned back to it, and I thought, oh, the real story, the story that I can write that everyone can relate to is the story of meeting a stranger who looks into your soul and recognizes you for the person you really are. And that's what that taxidermist did, because I'm sure he doesn't show everybody the head in the plastic bag, but he took one look at me and thought, I bet this guy would really like that. And he was completely right. The taxidermist, you know, he was contacted for the story. And
this was in the New Yorker, then, you're saying?
Yeah, it was in the New Yorker.
Which means the fact checkers.
Right. So the fact checker talked to the taxidermist, and the fact checker called me back and said, okay, I talked to him. Like, and you had in your story that you saw two orange kittens in the store, and he only had one. Head in the bag, oh, yeah, he's got that. And the forearm with the tattoo that his grandfather mummified, oh, yeah. And when the book came out in England, they said, we think you need to change this because the taxidermist could be identified. And, you know, you say some pretty bad things about him. And I said, no, I didn't. I said he does great work and that the owl that I bought was flawless and that he has these human parts. I said, I guess that would be bad if you were against taxidermy and if you were against human parts. But, you know, if you like that stuff, he's going to get business out of it. So it was just interesting how they perceived that as a critical story, where I thought that as a professional, I had nothing but good things to say about the guy.
There's a story about collecting the rubbish in your neighborhood. Are you still living in the country in England?
Yeah, we have a house in London, and then we have a house in West Sussex in an area called the South Downs. And it's unspeakably beautiful. And I was on this trip earlier. I was in the Berkshire Mountains in Massachusetts. And that's really pretty. you know, there's a lot of houses that are fairly newish. But kind of what's so nice about where we are is that the houses are all old and they kind of really beautifully kind of fit into the landscape. And the first time we went there, I didn't notice this problem with it. And I didn't really notice it until we bought a house and moved into it, is that the roadsides are carpeted with rubbish. It really bothers me. And so I spend hours every day picking up rubbish, and it's sort of become, really it's become my life. I mean, I work in the morning, and then I pick up rubbish for hours every day. There are trash cans that I know along the way on my route, and so I put the trash in a plastic bag, and I balance it, like a hefty bag, I balance it on the basket of my bike, and then I empty it, and then I collect more, and then I empty it. And then sometimes, like when all hell's broken loose, I mean, I've been gone since the last day of March, I've been gone, so all hell is breaking loose in my absence. So when I get back, I'm going to have so much to pick up. I work with the local council, and so I'll do a lot of stuff on foot. You know, I'll probably fill like 100 bags, hefty bags with trash. And then once that's clean, then it'll be clean enough for me to handle, and then I'll do it on my bike because I have to maintain. I have to cover the same ground every 2 days. If you let more than 2 days go by, you'll be buried in it.
Is this a major route or something that people are just throwing trash out their car?
It's not a major route at all. No, people just throw everything out their car window.
In all of England or just
all of
Sussex?
England.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's really bad.
Yeah. And in France, they don't do it. Italy, they do. It's interesting to me how it changes from country to country. But in my mind, like, America was so clean. But, like, driving here today, I was like, wow, that was a lot. It's not as bad as England. On this tour all through the United States, it's just been so much worse than I remembered it. Because I don't live here, it doesn't upset me in the way. Like, if Hugh and I go to a friend's house for dinner, I have to get in the car and look at the sky. I can't look at the ground or I'll be too upset.
I dog sit periodically. I had a dog for 15 years and then decided to retire undefeated, right? So now I dog sit, and I have a couple of dogs that I'm picking up their rubbish, of course, but yes.
I just wanted to write that down, retire undefeated.
When I'm walking the dogs, you know, I'm constantly looking at the rubbish under bar, picking it up and everything, and trying to make sense of why someone would throw a beer can under bar. It doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't to me either. And I never see anybody doing it. If I could see somebody, then I could say, oh, that's who does it. But I have to say, I'm not filled with anger about it. It's a really good hobby for me. It occupies me. It gives me a sense of purpose. I listen to things. You know, I listen to podcasts and books on tape while I do it. So it's not boring to me in any way. My neighbors, they think I'm crazy. They think I'm a crazy person. But that doesn't bother me either. I mean, I have to dress in rags because, you know, you're just going to get your clothes dirty. So they see this guy in rags and with an iPod on and talking to himself. When I'm talking to myself, it's usually I'm listening to a language tape and you're supposed to repeat after the speaker. So that's what I'm doing. But it doesn't bother me. I don't care what they think about me.
Are you wearing gloves?
Nah, gloves impede me. If I ask someone to kiss my hand, like, after I've been collecting, my hands are just black after I've been collecting rubbish. Yeah, nobody would. Even Hugh, I couldn't pay Hugh to kiss my hands after I've been collecting rubbish.
You're listening to an interview with David Sedaris, author of Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Two people have come up to me and said, explain the title to me. So what's the title about?
Well, I was signing books, and this woman came up, and sometimes it happens. People come up, and they're very demanding, you know, what they want in their book. And she said, I want you to write to my daughter, explore your possibilities. And I don't want to write that in a book. So I said, well, I'll keep the word explore. And again, I was just in that mood. So I wrote, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. And then I thought, I'm going to write a book with that name. I just loved it so much. It just satisfies me on every level.
What's the origin of Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk, which is a collection of bizarre tales involving animals who do unspeakable things to each other?
Someone gave me an audiobook, and it was South African folk tales. And I love audiobooks, and I was just so disappointed that the folk tales were just... I mean, there might be good ones out of South Africa, but this was just a bad collection. It was like the hyena and the giraffe. The giraffe marries a hyena, and then on their wedding night, he rips her throat out. So be careful who you marry. And I just thought, I can do better than that. So I wrote a story about a cat who goes to a baboon to get her hair cut. And I liked that it was just the cat and the baboon. None of the animals have names. There's a dog with a name. Their names are mentioned, but they're just like their slave names. So it's just a cat and the baboon. Everybody knows what a cat and a baboon looks like, so wham, you're just into the story. By the second line, you're into the story. And there's something I liked about that. A lot of people, you know, when I went on tour, have come up and said, please don't ever do anything like that again. Don't ever write a book like that again. I like you, but I just didn't like that at all. And I realize when I say I, people want me to mean myself. They want me to mean me. They don't want me to be I, but I'm a golden retriever. But people were nice about it. You know, they just, that's just not what they wanted from me. You know, you can't please everybody. And that wouldn't keep me from doing what I want to in the future. What I liked was how respectful people were about it, though. They were like, oh, I really like you, but I don't like that.
You've become known primarily for telling stories about your own life. So when you veer off from that, I think it probably scares people. Have you thought about writing like a novel, for instance?
I have a 10-page attention span. After 10 pages, I just don't give a damn anymore. So I know I could write short chapters. See, also, when I go on tour, I'm not going to read from a novel. I would never get up in front of an audience and read something that's an hour long. Because if you're in the audience and you're not into it, you're just gone. Instead, I like to read, like, I don't know, like 3 stories and then like 20 things from my diary. So if it's not for you, just wait 10 minutes and there will be something for you. So I probably wouldn't write a novel just because I can't imagine myself reading out loud from it. And nothing's worse than that setup. You know, like when you go to a reading and someone's reading from a novel and then they say, okay, in this chapter right here, Philip and Amanda, they're on their honeymoon and they've chosen to honeymoon in Milwaukee at the Intercontinental Hotel in Milwaukee, and it's the second day of their honeymoon. I guess I should explain here that Philip was married before. Philip was married before to Amanda's sister, okay? And Amanda's sister used to work with Phil. And I'm gone. Do you know what I mean? I'm no longer there. Setup kills. And if you wrote a novel and you were going to read from anything except from the very beginning of it, you'd have to do that. I don't want to do that.
Of course, you realize you don't necessarily have to read from your novel in front of an audience. You've got other material.
But I wouldn't know if it's okay or not if I didn't read out loud.
Really?
From it.
You don't trust your own inner sense on that?
No. No, I don't. I don't anymore. I mean, there was something I wrote for The New Yorker a couple of years ago. They did a food issue, and they asked me to write something. And it was like in a weird time, right? It was like, I don't know, maybe it was like February or something. And I wasn't going to be on tour for another like 6 weeks. And so I wrote it, and they ran it in the magazine, and I read it out loud, and I realized it didn't work at all. I don't like for things to be published unless I've had a chance to read them in front of an audience.
That's why you went to Berkeley in 2009 and did a week in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. Just for a book, basically.
Right. Yeah. I went to Berkeley for a week, and I loved that YMCA downtown. And I went to Steppenwolf for a week. And then for this book, I went to Boston for a week, and then I went to Denver for a week. And the same thing I read, and there was like small 300-seat lab theaters, 300-seat lab theaters. And it was billed as a work in progress. But, you know, one of the things I read when I was in Denver, it was like a little monologue, a little dramatic monologue I'd written. Like in the new book, there are these 6 little dramatic monologues included for teenagers to read at forensic competitions. And this one involved a woman who's talking through a locked door to her daughter. Stephanie, I know you're in there. Stephanie, open the door. Stephanie, I know you're upset about the clitoridectomy, but hear me out, okay? And so it was a woman who had gotten the family's maid to give her daughter a clitoridectomy so she could steal her daughter's boyfriend. And I would read this on stage, and I would think, what is this that I'm feeling? Like, I couldn't put my finger on the way I felt when I was reading that story. And a young woman in Denver came to the reading, and then she left at the end, And then she got a few blocks away, and then she came back. She got in the book signing line, and she said, you know, I left and I came back just because I have to tell you how I felt about that story. She said, it's like a rape joke. That's what it feels like. And she was completely nice about it. And I thought, wow, she's absolutely right. That it completely explains the way that's that feeling that I have that I couldn't put my finger on. So I pulled it from the book. Not because this one person didn't care for it, but she identified what I was so unsure of. Like, why doesn't this feel right to me? What's the problem here? And a stranger was able to, I mean, I don't poll people. Like, at the end of a night, I don't say, you know, what was your least, because I know what their least favorite, because I can tell I'm up there. But every now and then somebody will come up, and I don't even ask them. A young woman came up to me in Athens, Georgia, a couple of years ago. And in the story, I'm out to dinner with these people in China, and this woman orders these duck tongues, and I look at her, and I think, you whore. And it gets a nice laugh because she's, you know, she's like a college professor, so it gets a nice laugh. And this young woman came up, and she said, you know, when you call a woman a whore, you're calling all women whores. And I thought, no, sorry, I'm keeping that. That was a situation where I thought, no, I don't have to take all the advice that comes my way. But I do, you know, like I searched my soul and I thought, really, do I feel like all women are whores? And it's like, no, I don't. Just the ones who make me eat duck tongues.
I've never had a duck tongue.
They're not bad, but I'll tell you the best use for a duck tongue. I was in New York last week on my tour, and this German woman came up to me. And she said, I have a book to give to you. It's a book that I put together. And it was called Not a Rose. And I thought it was like a kind of a natural history book. There were pictures of flowers, right, in their natural setting. And there was a lot of text around them. And then I started looking through it. And I said, wait a minute. Like this plant right here, I'm not a big plant person. But I thought, what is this? And she said, that is made from duck tongues and part of a sheep's uterus. And she takes animal parts and she makes flowers out of them. And it's amazing, this woman's artwork. Just amazing. And that's the best use for a duck tongue, is to form a petal.
Getting back to what you were saying before, I think what happens is that when you're on the edge of bad taste, the question is, how do you know if you've crossed over and your line is always going to be different from someone else's?
Right. And I don't mind crossing over from bad taste. You know, I don't mind doing that. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it happens that you don't know how you feel about things. Often that happens to me. I don't know if it's just a personal problem or maybe it's the things that I'm doing, like saying to people, will you kiss my hand? Will you fork meat into my mouth? And I think, wait a minute, how do I feel about this? You know, I got a letter from this guy a few weeks ago who was at a show and, you know, he said, I came to your show expecting an hour's worth of wry social commentary. And for 50 minutes, you know, you met my expectations. Then you had to read this filth. And, you know, he went off. But I thought, well, 50 minutes, I mean, that's not bad.
I had an incident happen the other day. I'm interviewing Walter Mosley, right?
Uh-huh.
And at one point he uses the N-word,
uh-huh.
Right? And it was in the conversation. I'm thinking, I don't think, even though he's a black man and a well-known author, I don't know if I could get away with doing that. And I stopped him and said, can you please rephrase that? And he got huffy. But it's like you have to ask a question. I mean, that's a little easier for you not to be able to do that, but I'm kind of going, what are my responsibilities, and is somebody going to complain?
I mean, it's interesting to me. A few weeks ago, I did a show at the Opera House in San Francisco, right? And in one of the stories, I mentioned CPAC, right? And then people in the audience hiss. And it's like, and then I mentioned an anti-abortion billboard that I saw in Minnesota. And I'm like, really? What would happen if everyone seated around you didn't know how you felt about everything that's coming out of my mouth, you know? And I felt, too, like, yeah, I read about this anti-abortion billboard. I'm going to get to that. Do you know what I mean? And I'm actually going to do something much cleverer than sound like a leaky tire. So why don't you shut up? That's what I was sitting there thinking. But, you know, you can't not. offend people. I mean, I think all you can do is just examine your soul and think, okay, was I being cruel? Was I being, you know, I mean, if you're just, your point, is it my point to, like, just wind people up and get them angry? No, no. But anymore, especially, I think, with email. You know, in the days of yore, people had to put a stamp on things, and then they'd write their complaint letter, and then they'd look at it and think, is this really worth a stamp? But now it doesn't cost you anything, so.
Well, that's the problem with seeing any commentary on any article online. It's like, it doesn't cost you anything, it's just so easy to do, why not just, you know, throw out your first idea?
Well, that's the thing, too. It's hard for me to believe that people really have opinions about. You know, like if you made me say, how did I feel about, oh, I don't know, like an article about a book review of Walter Mosley's, how do I feel about that? I guess I would, if I had to say something, I would give you my response. But I just think it's funny that people will comment about everything. And it's like, well, sometimes I'm jealous and I think, gosh, I wish I had feelings about that many things. But most things in the world are okay to me. And I'm passionate. There are plenty of things that I'm passionate about. But I guess I'm just curious that, like, look at how much people have to say about the veins in Madonna's arms. Well, I wonder, too, like, even if you look on Yelp, and you're looking for Starbucks, so you look on Yelp, and you type in Starbucks, and there's you realize, oh, there's a Starbucks, like, right downstairs. And then the comments on it, like, I went into that Starbucks, and I asked for a latte, and I asked for it to be 360 degrees, and it was only 355 degrees. I like reading things like that because I try to picture the person who wrote it. Or in hotel reviews, I think often it's people who wanted an upgrade and they didn't get one. And so now they got an axe to grind, and so they do it that way.
Which of the essays in Let's Explore do you like the best, that you're most satisfied with?
Maybe Memory Lapse, I think. It's a story about swimming and about being on the swim team.
Is that a true story? Was your father raving about this other kid?
Yeah, when I was young and I was on the swim team, there was a boy on the swim team named Greg, and my dad just would not shut up about Greg, just wouldn't shut up about him. And, you know, when you're that age, you're 11, you're 12 years old, then you think, Dad wants Greg to be his son instead of me. And then my dad kind of moved over and started talking about Donny Osmond. And then I was so jealous of Donny Osmond because my dad wanted Donny Osmond as a son instead of me. It's something my dad's done all his life. My dad was an only child, so he never really understood the many children dynamic, right? He never understood that what happens, like, when you praise one child and the exclusion of all others. Because it never happened to him. And his dad was, like, really remote, so I don't even think his dad wouldn't have even acknowledged that my father was on the swim team if my father had been on the swim team. But, you know, it really kind of shaped who I am, and I'm not a conceited person, but I'm not that unhappy with who I am. So I don't mean it in a complainy way when I'm writing about the way that my dad was, because if he wasn't the way he was, then I wouldn't be who I am today.
Is he okay with your being a best-selling author, or is it that you're number two, not number one?
I mean, in that essay I wrote, at that point, When You Are Engulfed in Flames had just come out, right? And I called my dad and I said, my book's number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And he said, well, it's not number one on the Wall Street Journal list. So this book debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and it was also number one on the Wall Street Journal list. But I didn't even tell my dad. I sent him a copy of the book when it came out. I talked to him on the phone a couple weeks later. We did not mention my book. I did not mention that it was number one on the New York Times bestseller list, because if I did, then he just would have said, well, I didn't see it on the Raleigh News and Observer list, and so why put myself through that? He doesn't understand, like, books. My dad, he's not a reader. He doesn't.
Has he read your stuff?
Has my dad read my stuff? I know he's read some things. I mean, I give him the stories. I give him the books. If my father wrote a story about me, I wouldn't read it. I would tell him I read it, but I wouldn't read it. I mean, if you wrote a story about me, I wouldn't read it. I don't read anything about me. And I don't know, maybe my dad's the same way. I write him letters and he reads those. I mean, I think obviously, like, I wanted, you know, validation from my dad, you know, I mean, my whole life, but he's just always withheld it. And I don't know if that just is what made me jump higher or what, but I don't seek it anymore. That doesn't mean I don't care about him.
What about Amy's success?
My dad's the kind of guy, well, he loves Amy's success, but he doesn't have to be that way. Why did you have to make that face? Your dress was so pretty, then you had to open your mouth and use that four-letter word. Why did you have to do that? Like my dad, Amy and I wrote these plays together. My dad's never seen any. The only plays my father's ever seen are the ones that Amy and I wrote. And then he would call up and say, I got an idea for a play. And get this, Amy's pregnant, and she's talking to the fetus on the phone. And we say, well, Dad, that's not blah, baloney. That would work like a charm. Yeah, look, you got to give the fetus a crazy name, like Ernie. We call the fetus Ernie. And his ideas are so lame. But he wants to have a hand in it, right?
Right.
So he wants us to write a play in which Amy has a fetus named Ernie and she talks to him on the phone so my dad can say, that was my idea. He wants more of a stake in it. But I would argue and I would remind him that he has every stake in it. Do you know what I mean? He had everything to do with his children turning out the way that they did.
David Sedaris, Hugh reads all your stuff though, right?
Yeah, he reads it, but he would rather read things when they, like there's a story that, you know, the story that I'm closing with the New Yorker today. I sent Hugh the story because the fact checkers were going to call him. And he said, I'm just going to agree with whatever because he wants to read it in the magazine. He doesn't want to see it before it comes out in the magazine. But yeah, he reads everything.
The fact checker situation, of course, is very strange because you're writing comedy and you're writing exaggeration. And yet the New Yorker fact-checkers are going to make sure that it's not that way.
I don't want to be wrong for no reason, right? Like there's a story in the book about going to Costco with my brother-in-law. And it was a story about my last book tour, and I was giving out condoms to teenagers, right? So I went to Costco with my brother-in-law on a Sunday morning in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and we're walking through, and all we have in our shopping cart is a box of condoms, right? The size of a cinder block was how I describe it. And everyone's looking at us. You know, they think we're a couple and they see, you know, and they're thinking, is that all you gay people can ever think about is sex? And we wind up putting a 4-pound box of strawberries in there with it, right? Which just makes us look gayer. And the fact checker called and said, the biggest box of condoms that Costco sells is 24. And that's not the size of a cinder block. It's the size of a brick. And they don't sell 5-pound boxes of strawberries, just 4-pound boxes. So I said, okay, well, change the 5 to a 4 because I don't want to be wrong. But I will fight for the box of condoms the size of a cinder block because if you're with your brother-in-law in a small conservative town on a Sunday and all you have in your shopping cart is a box of condoms, it feels the size of a cinder block. And I'm writing comedy, right? It is not an article about how many condoms Costco sells. It's not an article about that, and you have to give me this because you have to give this to me. I mean, it seems kind of sad that you'd have to fight for a thing like that, but, you know, there you have it.
And what happened? They said, yeah?
Yeah.
David Sedaris, now you've got another collection coming out in 2 years? Is that right?
Well, you know what I thought I might do for my next book is sometimes I close the evening when I'm on tour by reading things from my diary. It's not higgledy-piggledy. I wouldn't just open my diary to any page, but they're things that work and get a nice laugh. So I thought maybe I'd put out a book of those. I worry that it might be like a bathroom book, you know, just like short things that are funny. And I worry a little bit about raiding my diary that way. But we'll see.
You say you've got these diaries that go back. You raid them anyway, don't you?
I raid them for stories. But when I read them out loud, they have to end a certain way, right? They have to end like on a laugh. They have to get a joke. I mean, they have to end on a laugh. And if they don't, then the audience reacts like, I just told a joke that's not funny. And I want to say, like, wait a minute, I know it's not funny. It wasn't supposed to be a joke. So if I did a book of them, I would include a lot of the longer ones that I just think are interesting. They're not necessarily, you know, they're not funny. They're what my diary's like, you know. It's like the guy who's sitting across the aisle from me on a high-speed train through Japan, a businessman wearing yellow socks and just beautifully, beautifully dressed with these canary yellow socks on. And then, the girl kind of clomping down the aisle with that sort of Japanese girl walk that young women can have there with her drinks trolley. And it was just like a moment, just like a little moment. Now, to me, it prompts a memory and it opens up all kinds of things, which it wouldn't to a reader. But when I read it over in my diary, I think, oh, that's kind of nice. It's really kind of a nice little, just to know that anywhere in the world, that this was just this little moment in this particular spot in the world. And I think it's nicely written. And, you know, so I think I would include things like that in it as well. So it wouldn't just be funny stuff. But, you know, like the other night, someone told me a joke. And I'd probably include jokes in there, too, that people have told me. Now, if I could credit the person who wrote the joke, I would do it, but who knows who writes jokes? Hugh wrote me the other day, and there's this quiz show that he listens to on the radio in England, and they had little bits of newspapers on the, you know, they read little bits of newspapers. And one of the things they read, it was from the TV listings, and it said, "There will be blood, period, drama." And then they also had, it was a woman who had been taken to court for not paying for her Botox injections. And the article said that she was found guilty and that she remained expressionless as a verdict was read. I'd include things like that.
You've been listening to an interview with David Sedaris, whose latest book is titled Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.